it's a pretty simple process. You come in and we have you do a task, and like I said, it only takes an hour and it's catered for. It. So we'd appreciate you coming in and participating. Any questions? Okay, then I'm going to pass these down, and if you could just give them over to Dimitri. Thank you.
Thank you.
is from his latest album, CD, I'm dating myself. It's a song about Karl Marx, which is why I played it, and it's called Life's Not Fair. I'm playing these because today we're going to talk about Marxist analyses of the mass media. I don't know how much any of you have read Marx or studied Marx. What has become clear to us in the department is that as culturally coming out of 101, just kind of a basic understanding of why Karl Marx and Marxism matters hasn't been there. So for those of you who've already read Marx, my apologies. For those of you who haven't, the basic thing that we're going to try to do here today is get you to understand why Karl Marx matters in the area of media studies. Okay? Now, so the first thing I want to do is I know that you all like my artwork so much, so I thought I'd put this nice triangle up here. Now, this triangle, which is actually not even a very good triangle given what we're going to be drawing, represents kind of income distribution in the United States, okay? So, this is the bottom of the barrel, okay? And this is right up here. See this person up there? That's Bill Gates, okay? All right, so that's Bill Gates up there. Okay, the richest person on the planet. All right. Who else is up here? Say it again. Okay, celebrities, right? Especially the successful celebrities like professional athletes, very well-paid actors and actresses like Harrison Ford, Mel Gibson, Demi Moore. Yeah.
Politicians.
Not really, and not quite up there. But they might be. Okay, we're calling this $100,000, so a lot of politicians would be like here, right?
Yeah.
Because a lot of politicians have made good, okay? All right. So up here we've got like Oprah, Madonna, okay, Bill Gates. Who else might be up here?
Yeah.
Donald Trump, Ross Perot, okay, sort of famous millionaires, right? And then there are people you guys haven't heard of probably much. I mean, I know you guys have heard of Phil Knight, right? The head of Nike, especially since a lot of you have been active in the anti-sweatshop movement. So Phil Knight, you know, Phil Knight's average annual compensation, not counting stocks, is, you know, like $1.5 million, and that doesn't count other kinds of income. But, you know, there are other people like John Welch, who you guys probably haven't heard of, the CEO of General Electric, whose compensation in 1996 was $20 million. I think it's a good salary for running General Electric. Anthony Wiley, the CEO of Heinz, okay, $24 million a year. Okay, so we have CEOs, certain CEOs up here as well, okay, and they are like way above the 100,000. Okay, now, this, we're going to do this in 1995 dollars because that's the most recent year that I have figures for, okay? Over $100,000, all the way up to Bill Gates, that's about 7.3% of the population, okay?
America?
This is the United States, yeah, the United States. All right, now, who's in here? Between 70,000 and 100,000. Who do we have in here? Oh, let's not forget, my dears, anchor men and women. Like Diane Sawyer, who makes $1 million a year. Okay. All right. Then, so we have this very rarefied area where the very rich are. Okay? What would be next down here? We also will have some, obviously we have some lawyers up in here, we have some surgeons up in here, right? How about in here, 70 to 100,000? Some journalists, some college professors, some business people, some middle management folks, right? Some salespeople.
College professors. college professors, accountants, some journalists, okay. The group in here, this is about 11%, okay? Well, about 11% makes this amount. Okay, then, and, you know, my drawing, as you guys know, is really bad, so this pyramid is not really approximating the percentages, but you get the idea, okay? All right, now we go from 45,000 to 70,000. Okay, who do we have in here? Other college professors, other journalists, okay? Small business people, high school teachers, other nurses, store clerks, some administrators, okay, maybe some carpenters. Okay, this is 21.8%, okay, earns this. Below this is 60% of the population. Now, way at the bottom, less than $10,000. $10,000. This is 1995 money. $10,000 is, as you guys know, nothing. 9.6% of the population. So nearly 10% of the population is trying to get by on $10,000 or less. Okay. All right. Let me ask you something. There are all these people down here, okay? And let me just, to break this out a little bit, between 10,000 and say 22.25 is another 19.1%. So we've got 30% right here, okay? Now, why is it that all these people down here say okay to this arrangement? They say, okay, there can just be a few really rich people on the top, and all the rest of us will stay on the bottom. That's just fine with us. Okay. Why do people say that? And they do say that in this culture, in our society. Well, this is the kind of question that Marxists ask, particularly Marxists who are looking at the role of the mass media in getting all of these people down here to say yes to Bill Welch making $20 million a year, to Madonna making all the money she does, to Oprah making all the money she does, to Michael Jordan making all the money. Okay, Marxists want to know, what role do the media play in getting all these people to say yes to what is clearly an unequal economic situation? And in this country, it is profoundly unequal. Okay, let me just give you a few more statistics. In 1992, the number of poor people in the United States reached its highest level since 1964. Okay, in the aftermath, we've done this video already. Okay, in 1991, the richest one-fifth of households got 46.5% of all household income. The poorest one-fifth got 3.8% of all income, household income. By 1995, the richest 1%, 1% pay of the population, owned approximately 40% of private wealth. Let me just give you some increases in average income between 1970 and 1995. And one of the things that especially happened during under Reaganism was a real tightening of the pressure on the middle classes. The rich got richer, the poor got poorer, and the middle class got really squeezed financially, beginning in the 1980s. Okay, so in a 25 period between 1970 and 1995, the richest 5% of the population saw their income go up 54%. Okay? So the richest 5% sees their income go up 54.1%. Okay? The top 20% saw their income go up 53.4%. And we'll just move down to the bottom 20%. Saw their income go up 1.5%. So you can see the rich were getting richer and the poor were getting poorer during this period. The median income in the United States in 1995 for men was $27,900. Okay. For women, this is median now. For women, it was 21. We could do other kinds of divisions as well along the racial lines, for example, as well as a geographical area. Okay, so media scholars who are influenced by Marx look at this situation and ask why so many people on the bottom who predominate in terms of population say okay to this arrangement. And they look to the mass media to get ideas about the role that the mass media may play in getting people to indeed say yes. So that's why we are going to learn about Marxism. Okay, those who analyze how the media help excuse and encourage unequal economic and political power relations have been profoundly influenced by Karl Marx. And they refer to their work as Marxist or neo-Marxist. Now, Marxism has made absolutely crucial contributions to analyses of popular culture. So, first I want to tell you who Karl Marx was and why those of us studying the media need to know about him and his work. So the first thing I want to do is distinguish between political Marxism and intellectual Marxism. Okay. Okay. Most of you probably know the term Marxism as a dirty word, right? As something that got in communism. Communism has collapsed in the former Soviet Union. It's collapsed in Eastern Europe. It's certainly very powerfully contested in China, right? And when most Americans hear the words Marxism, they don't think of intellectual Marxism, they're thinking of political Marxism. Okay. Political Marxism drew from Marx's writings, Marx and Engels' writings. And drawing from Marx and Engels' writings became a political program that you guys know primarily as communism and socialism, a political program for popular liberation designed to produce a classless society in which all goods were socially owned. In other words, a political program to get away, to do away with that triangle that we just saw, right? Say it again. A political program, and again, this is on the web, for popular liberation designed to produce a classless society in which all goods are socially owned. There were, as you know, enormous failures in political Marxism. It quickly became clear after the Russian Revolution, certainly by the early 1930s, that what existed in the Soviet Union was not the kind of communism that Marx and Engels dreamed of. They dreamed of a very utopian kind of society. Instead, what emerged in the Soviet Union by the 1930s was totalitarianism. okay, not communism. Communism was an effort to apply Marxist theories into practice, and communism sought to overthrow the capitalist regimes that existed, although there was not really a capitalist regime in Russia in the teens. It was very much still a feudal society, very much a peasant agrarian society. But the idea behind communism was that you would overthrow the capitalist system by revolutionary means, if necessary, and then establish this classless society. Now, socialism, which has, in fact, been much more successful and exists in a variety of countries around the world, also very much influenced by Marxism, and advocates a system of collective government ownership. So what socialism does is that socialism has not necessarily come about by violent revolutionary action, but has been more incremental, and advocates a system of collective or government ownership.
Collective
socialism? Yes, socialism. Okay. Advocates a system of collective or government ownership and the management of the means of production and distribution of goods. And yes, I will say again. Advocates a system of collective or government ownership and management of the means of production and distribution of goods. Now, what countries are socialist to some degree? Some of you have been to them. Canada is socialist to some degree. Britain is socialist to some degree, although the socialism of Britain was severely undercut by Margaret Thatcher and continues to be by Tony Blair's government, even though it's a Labour government. Okay. Sweden is a socialist country. Denmark has elements of socialism. So do France and Italy. In other words, a variety of countries in Europe have varying degrees of socialism, meaning that the government provides certain kinds of services to the population, that the government manages certain key industries, like, say, the railroads, or the airlines, or the public utilities, or the broadcasting systems. In the United States, we had the beginnings of a social welfare state that really began during the Depression and has been under assault, heavy assault, in the last 15 years or so. We have a much less socialist country. And in fact, most would regard our country as not socialist at all. It has a few tiny elements of sort of socialist practice, right? Like Medicare, Medicaid, food stamps, those sorts of things. But in this country, we believe in the sanctity of the market and private enterprise and private ownership. Intellectual Marxism is different, okay? And it's very important that you understand this because in this country, as I said before, since Marxism is such a dirty word, precisely because Marxist political systems have come into such disrepute, there's a tendency to conflate that with trashing intellectual Marxism. Okay? Intellectual Marxism is different. Intellectual Marxism has to do with an analysis of economic conditions, economic and political conditions. So it is an intellectual activity. And let me be more specific about that. Intellectual Marxism is an historical and economic analysis of how ownership of the modes of production produce different relationships between workers and non-workers. Marxism is an historical and economic analysis of how ownership of the modes of production produces different relationships between workers and non-workers, and this means between particularly workers and owners, okay, workers and owners, and different social and cultural institutions that perpetuate and justify inequality. Okay? It's also up on the web. Okay. Now, some have taken the failures of communism and the former Soviet Union and Eastern Europe as a complete refutation of Marxist theories. Others believed, of course, that the central truth of Marx and Engels, the central truths of their theories remain untouched because the kind of communism that we saw, for example, in the Soviet Union was such a bastardization of communism as envisioned by Marx and Engels. Now, intellectual Marxists would also point out the following facts, that despite the resiliency of capitalism, and capitalism has been an incredibly resilient and productive economic system, right? But that despite these successes of capitalism, that the capitalist world is still stalked by violence, it's still stalked by poverty, the capitalist world is stalked by injustice, and it's stalked by worker alienation. Anybody who has ever read a Dilbert cartoon knows the extent to which workers in this country, millions of them, are stalked by worker alienation. I'm sorry? Sure can. Intellectual Marxists would point to the fact that despite the fact that capitalism has been a very resilient, robust, and successful way of managing an economy, a very successful, robust economic system, that nonetheless, capitalist societies are stalked still by poverty, by violence, by injustice, and by alienation. And if we go back to our triangle, that's a triangle of the preeminent capitalist country in the United States, ours. And what do we see? That capitalism's biggest failure is to distribute the blessings of capitalism fairly. The blessings of capitalism are not distributed fairly. So we have a society here, for example, in which we have great wealth, and we also have absolute abject poverty. And this is a failure of this particular economic system. So I just want to make sure that in our discussion, you know that what I'm talking about is intellectual Marxism, not political Marxism. Okay? Now, who was Karl Marx? Karl Marx was born in Germany in 1818. He studied law, but he earned his degree in philosophy, his PhD in philosophy, in 1841. Marx was from Prussia. For those of you who know old German maps, Prussia is the northern part of Germany. That was a very large part of Germany. Germany included Berlin. And during the time that Karl Marx was coming of age, it was run very autocratically. It was run with an iron fist. Freedom of speech, freedom of religion were not guaranteed. The government exerted strict censorship on publications in schools. And Marx was also coming of age during the real explosion in Europe of the Industrial Revolution, the real rise of industrialism, which was particularly taking hold in Britain and in Germany. Now, Marx supported himself by his writing. He was a newspaper editor in the 1840s. He also wrote, was a stringer for the New York Herald Tribune. Many Americans don't know this, that Karl Marx actually wrote for American newspapers. He never made much money. Karl Marx lived in very desperate poverty most of his life. He married in 1841. He and his wife had six children. Three of them never made it to adulthood. And it was a very hard life that he lived. One of the major ways that Marx survived was through the generosity of his friend and lifelong collaborator, Friedrich Engels. Now, Marx's writings and his political beliefs, which became increasingly critical of Prussian authority and increasingly radical, made it impossible for him to stay in Germany. So Karl Marx emigrated to London in 1850.
Okay, where?
London. He went to London in 1850. And for those of you who have ever been to the British Museum, you can go to the room where Karl Marx used to go and write Das Kapital, very famous thesis. Now, Marx and Engels met in 1842. Engels was able to support Marx through much of, all of Marx's life. He came from a fairly well-to-do business family. And the reason this partnership worked so well is that Engels was the better writer, Marx was the deeper thinker. This is not to say that Engels did not influence Marx thinking. He did. Engels wrote books on his own, but they collaborated on a book that I'm especially going to talk to you about today because it has had such an enormous influence in media studies. Now, what they did is they began studying and writing about the exploitation of factory workers by factory owners. And what Marx and Engels did, for example, is they compiled a lot of data from income information in England in the 19th century to show that, in fact, as England had become more industrially wealthy, that the workers were actually more immiserated than ever. So the world that Marx was seeing was one of increased worker exploitation. And Marx believed that as this worker exploitation became utterly unbearable, that the workers would unite, workers of the world unite, and they would stage a revolution. They also began then more theoretical analyses, excuse me, of how capitalism as an economic system worked. And there's a word that some of you have already heard, some of you will hear, political economy. Which is the analysis of how the state and the corporate sphere interact. Political economy looks at the relationships between the corporate sector and the state to see how that interaction shapes business practices, shapes regulation, shapes cultural institutions. Now, at the heart of their work was the claim that how a society produces its means of existence, its mode of production, ultimately determines the political, social, and cultural shape of that society. Okay? So at the heart of their work, this is a claim that how a society produces its means of existence, its mode of production, ultimately determines the political, social, and cultural shape of that society. That how a society produces its means of existence, its mode of production, determines the political, social, and cultural shape of that society. So, let me give you some examples. Here are different modes of production. Feudalism is a mode of production, right? You have the big guy with the castles, okay, the aristocrats, and you have the peasants. That's one mode of production. There have been slave societies that have basically been slave master societies. There are industrialists and workers in an industrial capitalist mode of production. In other words, what they're really emphasizing is that the economic arrangements, okay, the economic arrangements of society drive that society. It's the economic relations that determine the nature of that society. Okay. very, we all struggle here not to do overlap. But sometimes it's unavoidable. All right. Let me talk to you about the most sort of important sets of notions here that shape people's thinking about ideology, base and superstructure. Can everybody, can you guys the back see this? I'm sorry? It's on the web. Yep. Okay, the base. The base refers to the forces of production and the relations of production. These are two, it sort of encompasses two things, okay? The forces of production are things like the raw materials, the tools, the technology, the workers themselves and the workers' skills. Okay, these are all the forces of production. But the base also includes relations of production that emerge from these forces of production and how they're set up. Okay? The class relations of those engaged in the production. So in other words, each mode of production, and we talked about this just a minute ago, with agricultural, industrial, produces particular relations of production. Master, slave, lord, peasant, bourgeois, capitalist versus proletariat. One's class position then is determined by one's relation to the mode of production. The other major element of society then is referred to as a superstructure. These are various institutions, political, religious, educational, cultural. And the forms of social consciousness that arise from the basic mode of production. In other words, these are institutions that emerge as a result of the mode of production. So that certain kinds of cultural institutions, Marx and Engels would argue, would arise from a feudal peasant society, and different kinds of institutions would arise from an industrial society. But that the nature of those institutions is determined by the mode of production. So the superstructure expresses and legitimizes the base. While the base determines the content and form of the superstructure. Okay, that's not up here. So the base determines the content and form of the superstructure. So let me just elaborate a little bit, then we'll get to false consciousness. So the economic base produces the kind of superstructural terrain. But the form of the activity that takes place there is determined, it's determined not just by the base, but also by the interaction of those other institutions. So as you guys know, if you look at the educational system, the media, religious institutions, there's often powerful interaction among these institutions that are part of the superstructure. But what matters here for you guys in sort of classic Marxism, is that culture can never be the primary force in history. It can be an active agent in social change. Culture can be an agent of social change, but it can never be the primary force in history. Okay, do you have any questions about base and superstructure? Benefiting from it. In other words, words, Marxism asks you constantly to think about the base as a driving force, you know, the economic modes of organizing a society, the particular forces of production, how those shape what you're seeing culturally. Now, one of the arguments that emerged out of classic Marxism was the notion of false consciousness. Do you have this written down yet? Are you still working on it? Got it? Okay. Let me give you a little background on this. I just want to give you a few quotes. This all comes from, this is on the web, and it's not here. Very famous book. Some of you may have already read, The German Ideology. Okay, The German Ideology was written by Marx and Engels and has had enormous impact on certain sectors. It was written in 1845. Okay. Now, what they do in part in The German Ideology is really lay out a kind of theoretical terrain about what kind of ideas come to be sort of the common sense of the times, right? And here's what they say, and this is a very famous claim. The ideas of the ruling class are in every epoch the ruling ideas. And I'll say that again. The ideas of the ruling class are in every epoch the ruling ideas. In other words, anybody can make it to the top. Anybody can become a millionaire. Anybody can become president. People who are poor, they deserve to be poor. They're lazy. People who are rich deserve to be rich. They earned it. Okay? These kinds of American platitudes, a Marxist would say, benefit elites. Right? Because they don't interrogate unequal monetary economic relations. They just accept them as the natural order of the world. And then if people accept them as the natural order of the world, right, then nobody's going to challenge the position of those people who inhabit the top 1%. Everybody will just say, that's how it is. They're rich, they deserve to be rich. Poor people deserve to be poor. If I just work harder, I can make it to the top. Okay, that's what they mean by the ideas of the ruling classes being the ruling ideas. In other words, ideas that benefit the ruling classes, according to a Marxist, become so naturalized, you know, just so taken for granted, that everybody buys into them, even though they are ideas that do not benefit the vast majority of the society. So even though, in fact, it is not true that anybody can become a millionaire, it is not true that anybody can become president, it is not true that poor people deserve to be poor, or that all rich people deserve to be rich. Many of them were lucky. They inherited it. Okay? Even though many of these things are not true, the belief system is very powerful and works to help us see the way things are. That triangle that we saw as taken for granted way of looking at the world. Okay? Now, let me just read you another a quote from the German Ideology. What they argue is that the class that controls the means of material production, the classes who control the factories, right, that build cars, that build trains, that build cities, that class also has, at the same time, control over the means of mental production. In other words, according to this argument, those who control the industrial production of the country, who are the wealthy people who basically build things and have money, also control the mental production of the country. Those who lack, okay, those who lack those kinds of financial resources also lack the ability, right, to have their ideas come out and be considered on the same level, because they don't have the resources to get their ideas out in the same way. They don't own the newspapers. They don't own museums. Later on, long after Marx is dead, they don't own radio stations, they don't own television stations, they don't own advertising agencies. The predominant ideas common to a capitalist society are those of the ruling class, according to Marxist analysis. Now, these might not be the only ideas, but they are the ruling ideas that dominate the consciousness or actions of those outside the ruling class. Now, what the ruling classes are compelled to do under these circumstances is represent their interests as the common interests of all society. And why is this so compelling? Well, people do want to think that maybe I could become a millionaire. Maybe I could make it to the top, and then I'll have all those benefits that those other people do. There's something very attractive about this narrative, about this story, that is a story of possibility, right? Story of possibility. Any of us can do it. We don't live in a caste system in this country. It can happen to anybody. So there's something very compelling about this particular narrative. Now, one of Marx's key metaphors for ideology is a false consciousness. This is the irrational or illusory thinking produced by class interest and social formation. I know this sounds really jargony. But basically, it refers to the ideas imposed on the majority by the rulers of society. Let me give you just something close to home. I can give you lots of examples of false consciousness. A Marxist might look at my position, for example, and say the following. You think that what you are is an educator. You think that what you're doing is enriching the minds of young people and influencing their lives, and you're doing this very noble, good thing, trying to change the world. But really, what you are is a worker in a knowledge factory. That's all you are, a worker in a knowledge factory. And that you have an illusion that gets you, through the day. But it's merely an illusion. It's false consciousness. One example of a variety. Okay. False consciousness tries to explain why workers have frequently been in support of the very system that exploits them, right? Or have stayed removed from labor unions or class struggle. False consciousness tries to explain why it is that people on the bottom of that triangle go, okay. And they go okay because they believe in the belief system that promises them access to the top. Now, Marx is a very famous example of this, which I'm sure you all know, is that religion is the opiate of the masses. We've all heard this. That religion was a kind of narcotic that substituted dreams of happiness in the hereafter for demands for social justice right now. Right? And there have been Marxist critiques, for example, of the role of Christianity in slavery, in keeping African-American slaves in the United States wedded to their position by using Christianity to promise them a noble, wonderful, glorious life hereafter. Now, what people subsequent to Marx have looked at, especially as the power of religion has declined and the power of the mass media have increased, is how the mass media have become the opiate of the masses. Right? That it's the mass media, really, that lull us into a sort of distracted, happy, deluded state where we're not going to go to the socialist meetings, we're not going to go to anti-sweatshop activist meetings, we're not going to just really try to change the world. It's like, I'm tired, I'm going to go watch Party 5. Right? So what Marxist media critics do, in part, is look at the way in which media products divert people away from political knowledge, divert people away from political historical knowledge that would, for example, connect you guys to long enduring histories of youth movements in the 20th century, many of which have been radical, to workers' movements in the 20th century, to anti-war activism, to civil rights movements and feminist movements, etc. Okay? Marxist arguments would look at how the media kind of obliterate that kind of history. So in fact, you don't know much history, you don't want to know much history. What's in it for you, right? Okay? And a Marxist would say that that kind of eradication of history that would tie you to other young people like you and tie you to a history that might resonate with you is a very effective and potent use of the mass media to depoliticize you. Okay, but the mass, one of the functions of the mass media is to depoliticize you if you not care about politics at all. That in fact, what a Marxist would argue, is that the main function of the mass media is to reaffirm the status quo. Status quo is great. Oh, there may be some problems, but basically the status quo is great. This is the best economic system in the world. We should all be happy and shut up and go make money. Now, as you remember from the very beginning of class, when we talked about definitions of ideology, this is the other thing that Marx and Engels put on the table. They didn't want us to think about ideology as some kind of programmatic set of beliefs or propaganda, right? But they wanted us to think about ideology as the common sense values and attitudes that sustain unequal power relations. So that's where a lot of this new thinking about ideology came from. Now, if there were debates about the extent to which Marx and Engels were economic determinists, we've used the word technological determinists before, but the extent to which they were economic determinists, meaning that always and only in the last instance, it's the economy that drives everything. Huge debates in the academy about this. But somebody who only looks at these kind of economic interests, let's say of the mass media, for example, and argues only from economic interests, could be called a vulgar Marxist, okay? Because they're doing a kind of very mechanistic reading of Marx. It's always a good insult to hurl at somebody, vulgar Marxist. All right. Now, if you wanted to make a case for Marx and Engels, analysis is applied to the mass media, you'd begin with the following, okay? You'd say, look at who owns the media right now. Look at who owns the media right now. Who owns the media right now? Owned by a few huge international, global media monopolies. Okay, the very rich and the very powerful. Rupert Murdoch. Disney, Time Warner, okay, a few major corporations, very wealthy corporations, own almost all of the media outlets in the United States. Radio stations, television stations, the studios that produce programming, advertising agencies, magazines, books, record companies, they own it all. Okay, so first of all, you look at who owns the stuff and say, this is all concentrated in the hands of a few capitalist, very wealthy capitalist owners. Okay, so that would be step one in the argument. Therefore, you would argue, since they own this stuff, it's their ideas that are going to receive much greater prominence than the ideas of other people. And even though some of what they produce might seem like it's, you know, geared to disaffected women, or people of color, or seeks to show poor people a little bit. That's all kind of a mask. Okay, it's all sort of a mask. But really, what's getting out there over and over, because they own the stuff, are their ideas. And their ideas predominate, would the argument go. And therefore, third part of the argument, because of that, then this ideological domination comes to sort of surround us all, that we're all embedded in this ideological domination that they produce. And what that means then, since we all buy into it, is that it maintains the existing system of class inequality, which allows that triangle to exist. Okay? So, A, they own it. B, because they own it, it's their ideas that predominate. Other kinds of ideas not consonant with those ideas don't get much airplay. C, because their ideas predominate, most of us, that's our imaginations are kind of stuck. If that's what we come to believe, we don't get much other alternative ways of looking at the world. And therefore, the status quo, which benefits them, is maintained. Okay? That would be like a classic Marxist argument about media. Okay. Let me just give you a few examples of how a Marxist might take on various aspects of the media. And I want to talk about pseudo-individuation, too. It's up here, pseudo-individuation, individuation, standardization of media forms and audience tastes, through patterned, predigested, and endlessly recycled cultural entities. Okay. I will unpack that for you. What's the difference between In Sync, 98 Degrees, The Backstreet Boys, The New Edition, and New Kids on the Block? Say it again.
The popular.
I couldn't hear it, sorry.
New
Kids on the Block are the best, is one answer we have down here. What are the differences? Look, they are all these cute boys who can dance. Most of them don't play instruments, okay? What they play is the audience, okay? They are each socially differentiated so that the presumptive female band can identify, she can choose her New Kid or her Backstreet Boy, whether it's Howie or, I don't have one age, right, okay? Sorry, you know. Howie's not bad, I haven't seen it all, so I know that. But basically, here's what a Marxist pseudo-individuation argument would say. This is the same damn group. Same group. From New Edition, New Kids on the Block basically rip off New Edition, and a lot of other kinds of black music and black culture, come out, they're androgynous, they're cute, they dance, they're not threatening, they showcase a kind of feminized masculinity, they're a huge hit, then, you know, they get dumped on, then we get another one. Now what's happened? A Marxist would say the following. There is a new movement of young girls in the United States just ripe for the picking, and there's plenty of room for a couple of these bands, In Sync, Backstreet Boys, etc., and throw in a few girls too, like Britney Spears. Okay? They're the same band, but it doesn't matter because what a capitalist culture industry does, according to a Marxist argument, is it produces the same thing that it knows works over and over and over and over. Just recycles it over and over. You might have slightly different embellishments. For example, if my memory serves me correctly, well, there were like certain kinds of hairdos that the New Kids have that are probably different from the hairdos that the Backstreet Boys have, right? And, you know, some of them, one guy has, you know, this very clearly laid out sort of facial hair marker, and another one doesn't. These are stylistic flourishes that seek to distinguish the Backstreet Boys from everybody else, but they're simply stylistic flourishes meant to mark difference where no difference exists. And what we get, hey, the New Kids work, the Backstreet Boys work, and NSYNC work, so let's keep cranking the stuff out. And what happens, this is just one kind of example, so what do we get according to this argument? A very standardized kind of popular music with very sort of standardized modes of address to the audience and standardized ways for this particular kind of male band, which is a very particular kind of defined male band, right, to behave and perform. And that this is just one example of the endless standardization that confronts people in popular culture. And when you are basically surrounded by this kind of pseudo-individuation in music, and then you turn on television, and what's on? Here are the shows that are on. There are a bunch of friends living in an apartment in New York City. About five of those kinds of shows. There's a young woman working in publishing with some sort of smart-ass staff around her. Another kind of show. Just Shoot Me Something, Susan, right? They're all the same show. All the same show. Okay? back in before you guys were born, there were these cop shows. I don't know if you've ever seen any of these reruns. Starsky and Hutch, Kojak, Simon and Simon. They were all the same show too. It was two guys. There was a slightly homoerotic charge there. They had two different outfits. Maybe they had an odd pet, but it was the same show. It was two guys solving crimes. All right, so what is the argument here from a Marxist perspective about pseudo-individuation? Here's what a Marxist would say, and again, I'm laying this out for you all. I'm not asking you to necessarily adopt this view, because there are criticisms, there are important inventions that we'll talk about on Thursday into Marxism. I want you to understand what it is, okay? So what a Marxist would say is the cumulative effect of all of this, like, pseudo-individuation, the same stuff over and over and over and over, okay, is that your imagination becomes stunted. You can't even imagine sort of other ways of thinking about the world or engaging in storytelling or engaging in music making. And already your radar detector should be going up given what's happening. All of the various things that happen in music that are very much in opposition to, say, Britney Spears, right? Okay. But the argument would be that your imagination in this kind of culture industry, in which it's very much in the owner's interest to keep giving us more, more, more of the same, 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 that is happy, your major goal in life should be to be happy. If you're happy, you'll go buy more stuff. You won't be thinking about much of anything else because you'll be on the stuff watching Carolina. Okay, that your imaginations, your political imagination, as well as your intellectual interest and ability in thinking differently about the world is suffocated by pseudo-individuation. Okay? That's the argument. Let me just give you one or two other arguments, and then I want to set something up really quickly before we go away. Okay. It was, let's see, you all were, how old were you guys when Desert Storm happened?
11,
10, yeah? Okay. All right, so you remember the Butcher of Baghdad, right? The Butcher of Baghdad. And let me just give you again a Marxist reading of Desert Storm. This is child's play, by the way. Since news management by the U.S. government was so rigid and censorship so utterly and totally complete that various publications filed a suit in federal court against charging prior restraint by the government. But the government was only letting out, you know, certain kinds of images of Norman Schwarzkopf and all other kinds of images didn't get out. That it was a very, very carefully orchestrated, quote-unquote, war. So what would a Marxist say about this? Okay, first of all, it was in the U.S. government's interest to present Desert Storm as a quick and just victory in which the United States' clear military and moral superiority were demonstrated without question. Right? That's what was in the U.S. government's interest. So we get Saddam saying, now, if you want to mobilize public opinion around this war, what do you need? You need a really bad enemy. Right? A really bad guy. So Saddam Hussein becomes Hitler. He's the Butcher of Baghdad. And in fact, on certain publications, his mustache was altered by airbrushing, so it looked more like Hitler's mustache. The news was carefully managed. Now, and you know some of the stories. We went in, we kicked butt, we got out. Okay? Now, what didn't get reported? The news that U.S. forces had killed over 100,000 Iraqi soldiers, many of them still teenagers, was buried from government press releases and buried from much of the nightly news. Also, not really covered. You will know that there's still, the United States still has imposed an embargo on Iraq. And by the way, I am not holding up Saddam Hussein as any paragon of virtue, okay? This is not about suggesting that Saddam Hussein is anything but what he is. But it is about the use of government propaganda to mobilize public will and to give the American public only some information and not others so that it will go along with what the government wants. This embargo, okay, as of 1996, this is 3 years ago. Now, you know what this embargo does? It doesn't allow water purification to go, any kind of water purification systems, to enter Iraq. It's an embargo on pure water. It's an embargo on insulin and other kinds of medicines. It's an embargo on pain relievers and anesthesia. Now, what is the effect of this, and what was the idea behind the embargo? Oh, if the United States has the embargo, of course the Iraqis are going to rise up and overthrow Saddam Hussein. Well, what's the real result of the embargo? That 500,000 children by 1996, 500,000 kids under the age of 5 died because of the embargo. Okay? Another kind of piece of information that was not played up in the national news. So a Marxist would look at this constellation of how Saddam Hussein was presented, what kinds of news was foregrounded about military success, what kind of news was repelled or played down or didn't get any play at all, and look at the way in which the state powerfully controlled people's understandings of that war and therefore contained people's criticisms of that war. The other thing a Marxist would say is would look at, there were actually a lot of anti-war protests around this war, and they were not covered on national news. So a Marxist would look at how the anti-war movement, the anti-war response to Desert Storm, was simply brushed aside and not even covered. So if your television was your only source of information, all you would know was that this was a whopping success. Hardly anybody got hurt. There was no opposition in the United States. War over. Okay? Now, I want to just give you two different, I want to now contrast Marxism with liberal pluralism, because I want to give you an alternative framework to think about.
Thank you.
of brainworms, but they lack ready access to alternative meaning systems that will, you know, allow them to see the world differently, okay? That will allow them to reject the definitions offered by the media in favor of oppositional definitions. So in other words, according to a Marxist, some audiences at some time, you know, might be able to talk back or say, I don't believe this, or contest what they're saying, but that for the most part, they really can't do an engaged, sustained, oppositional talkback because they don't have other meaning systems that would allow them to do that. Okay? And finally, the media themselves, according to a Marxist, relay interpretive frameworks that are consonant with the interests of the ruling classes. So however a desert storm is interpreted, however airlines crashes are interpreted, however political campaigns are interpreted, or riots or demonstrations, the dominant interpretive frame is consonant with the interests of the ruling classes, a Marxist would argue. Okay? Now, the Marxist tradition, just to emphasize this, it comes very much out of the European intellectual tradition. So it's a much more of a European intellectual tradition that has come to the United States. And the Marxist approach to thinking about the media emerged in sort of disguised form a little bit in the 1950s, but really took hold in the 1970s in the United States. Now, by contrast, we have liberal pluralists, and they have a different view of society and the media in that society. They see society not as constant class domination with elites always on top, but they see a complex of competing groups and interests. So that society, you know, there's constant struggle and negotiation, and some groups are dominant sometimes and other groups are dominant other times. So they might look at a period when labor unions were very, very active and very powerful in the United States, gained their power, say, in the 1930s and 40s, and say, look, this is a time when management was relatively weak, given the power of labor unions, and then things began to change again in the 1970s. Or they might look at the difference between Democrats and Republicans, or other kinds of groups. Media organizations, then, according to a liberal pluralist, do enjoy an important degree of autonomy. Okay, they are autonomous institutions. They talk back to the state. They talk back to corporations. They keep them in check, a liberal pluralist would argue. Again, I apologize for this control of the media. This should say media professionals right here. This should say media professionals. Okay, they constitute an autonomous managerial class. Okay? And they have flexibility. They have control. They have a lot of power to shape what comes out of media, according to liberal pluralists. Audiences, then, are not, either dupes or passive, but audiences engage into a voluntary relationship with the media on relatively equal terms. Let me move this up. And they can challenge the media in all kinds of ways, right? You can turn off your radio, turn off your TV set, not buy the magazine, not go to the particular film, you can check what you see. So in this view, audiences have the power to negotiate. And the media themselves constitute a place where various class views are fought out, but none predominates all the time. And there's much more of an image here of contestation, that there isn't a dominant class that always wins, whose worldview constantly prevails. So these are, as you can see, somewhat different ways of thinking about the power of the media and the media's relationship to society. Right? And what you will find, what I want you all to think about as you are looking at advertising or watching television or engaging in whatever kind of media consumption